Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Hello. Today I'm joined by John Preston. Preston is a journalist and best-selling author of numerous works of history and historical fiction. In 2017, the BBC adapted for television A Very English Scandal, Preston's true crime novel about a 1979 murder trial of British MP Jeremy Thorpe. His 2006 novel, Dig, a retelling of the discovery of the Anglo-Saxon Sutton Hoo ship burial in 1939, was recently adapted into a film by Netflix. In his latest book, Preston returns to a theme familiar to much of his past work: the scandals and misdemeanors at the heart of the British establishment. The Mystery of Robert Maxwell chronicles the spectacular rise and fall of Robert Maxwell, the Czech-born British media tycoon who rivaled Murdoch for control of the nation's newspapers. And Charmed and Terrified, his way to the top from obscure beginnings in Central Europe. John, writing about Robert Maxwell must be like clutching jewel dust. There is so much there, and yet he remains an elusive figure to capture truthfully. Tell me a bit about your sources. How do you go about it? How did the project start?
It started vaguely in the wake of when I wrote a book called A Very English Scandal about the Jeremy Thorpe affair, and I was casting around for something else to do. And someone at the production company mentioned Maxwell, and I was very dismissive and said, oh, I thought it was a terrible idea. Then I went home and I thought about it, and I actually thought, no, I'm mad. It's actually a terrific idea, and it's a very good time to do him. And also, quite coincidentally, I was at school with Ian Maxwell, one of Robert Maxwell's sons, and we've been friends off and on for the last, you know, however many years. Oh. So I did have potentially this kind of great source on the doorstep. So I talked to Ian, and he was, you know, wary, but certainly prepared to entertain the idea. And it rather went on from there, actually. And I found myself going and talking to all kinds of strange people who'd known Maxwell and worked for Maxwell, you know, his valet and his chauffeur and his chef and all these kinds of people. And the more research I did, the more fascinating it became.
So before the age of 23, Robert Maxwell, originally Jan Ludwig Hock, had changed his identity four times. That tells you a bit. What do we know of his early upbringing in Czechoslovakia?
Well, he'd been born and brought up in this dirt poor town in the west of Czechoslovakia, as it then was, which had a large Jewish population. And Maxwell's family was Jewish. He left to essentially to go and seek his fortune when he was about 15. And three of his siblings, both his parents and his grandfather, all died in Auschwitz. So that's really the kind of prism that you need to look at Maxwell's life through, because it coloured everything, really. And he, as a young man, joined up with the British Army. He had actually a very distinguished war, won a military cross, was presented by Field Marshal Montgomery. And then Maxwell, as a young man, had dreamt of finding a commodity that would be in great demand after the war, which he could obtain for next to nothing. And in 1946 in Berlin, he was sitting in his office one day. He was running an Allied newspaper designed to reintroduce Berliners to the virtues of democracy. And this man walked in, who was the biggest publisher of scientific journals in Germany, and said, Can you help me? I've got this huge stockpile of stuff because no research had been published during the war. And Maxwell thought, my God, you know, the commodity I've been dreaming of for all these years has just landed in my lap, and it's knowledge. And none of the academics who'd written any of these papers expected to be paid. So he could basically get them for nothing. So that became the cornerstone of his publishing empire.
I also wonder why, you know, so he sees that. There's an opportunist therein. We'll go into his character, which is fascinating in many ways. So he realized that. But is it, there's an ambition with Maxwell. So where does it come from originally, you think?
Well, I think he was a... I mean, he had some... There was no obvious entrepreneurial gene in his family. I mean, his father sold animal skins off the back of a mule. So, I mean, you know, he was incredibly poor. But Maxwell had kind of sold trinkets, you know, when he was 12 to supplement his pocket money. Actually, I don't think he even had any pocket money. And he was really good at it. So he was a kind of natural salesman in that respect. And he was kind of, you know, unencumbered by that much in a way of morality. You know, that made life to some extent easier for him.
And also, I think, especially for what he's then able to do later on in life, if you look at his career as a soldier and what he's doing during the war, because he shows, you know, quite a lot of cruelty as well.
Yes, he was very brave, and also, I suppose, very cruel. I mean, he certainly. He shot the mayor of a French town through the head in the middle of the town square to deter any of the inhabitants from taking up arms against the British. He's also may have shot unarmed German soldiers who had in fact surrendered. But although there's pretty compelling evidence to suggest that he did. But, you know, in many respects, that kind of encapsulates the contradictions at the heart of Maxwell. Yes, he was brave as a lion, but he was also extremely cruel and ruthless.
Did you think the wartime experience affected his future behaviour in any way?
I think it defined him in a lot of ways. I mean, it, as it were, made him British. He adopted the name of Maxwell because it sounded faintly Scottish, which he liked, and also had no Jewish connotations at all, which he also liked because he denied being Jewish for years and years and years. And he tried to reinvent himself as an English gentleman. And you could argue that he didn't get very far, but he was a tremendous Anglophile. I mean, he essentially taught himself English by listening to Winston Churchill's speeches on the radio, although he couldn't at the time understand a word Churchill was saying. But if you you know, analyse Maxwell's voice, which was tremendously fruity, you know, there's a sense that he's sort of taken sort of some of Churchill's rumbling cadences and then added an extra helping of treacle on top.
You know, and after the war, as you mentioned, Maxwell laid the seeds of his publishing empire. But there were also the seeds of his bullying and fraudulent business style. What transpired between Maxwell and his first business partner, Kurt Wallensteiner?
Well, I mean, you say that. Yes, it's certainly true that, you know, Maxwell always flew very close to the wind, and he went into partnership with this man, Kurt Wallensteiner, who was in many respects just as rackety as Maxwell. And they tried to import all this condemned meat into Britain, and no one would touch it. So they kind of shunted it around Europe. In fact, I think it ended up in Germany, where the food standards were much, much lower. And then Maxwell pretty much did the dirty on Wallensteiner. But, you know, Maxwell, for all his kind of faults, was a brilliant businessman. He may have been ruthless, but he was astonishingly good at it. And so much so that, you know, by the mid-1950s, having only come to Britain 10 years earlier, he's the largest publisher of scientific manuscripts in the world, which is an astounding achievement.
Yeah. But also wonder if, you know, so you said that the wartime experience affected him. And of course, during those years and after the war, there's a lot of these things going on. This is sort of a law of the jungle in many ways, and he sometimes referred to exactly that. That also when he himself is sort of being the victim of it, so he certainly sees it as a battle, doesn't he?
I think everything was a battle with Maxwell. I don't think he really had much, if any, capacity for human relations. Certainly not human relations conducted on an equal footing. There was always something tremendously sort of adversarial and locking horns about the way in which Maxwell seems to have related to other people.
Mm. During the wars, he meets his wife, Elizabeth Maynard, and she remains a huge part of his life, even as the marriage then later deteriorates. So how would you describe their dynamic, given that he had a very hard time to form any sort of normal friendships with other people?
Yes, I mean, there's no doubt that it was a passionate love match to begin with. I mean, you read their love letters to one another, they're extremely tender. I mean, really rather beautiful. And the marriage was happy for really quite a long time. And they had 9 children, 2 of whom died. And it's only when you get into the 1960s and you begin to feel that possibly Maxwell is actually being driven by forces that he never kind of fully understands and possibly can't control. In many respects, the story of Maxwell's life is a kind of terrible morality tale of someone for whom nothing was ever enough. Mm. And that becomes more and more apparent the older he gets.
And does it become apparent for Betty as well, as her nickname?
Yeah, I think it did, because he started treating her terribly badly. There's a point at which when the Maxwell's youngest child, their daughter Ghislaine, obviously now much in the news, she is born in the same week that their oldest son, Michael, the heir apparent, was very badly injured in a car crash, and he spent the next 7 years in a coma and then died. And in a lot of respects, that's the point at which what has hitherto been really quite a kind of harmonious family starts to kind of fracture at the seams.
But what's the dynamic between Betty and Roberts?
Well, I think that he was very respectful to her to begin with, in quite a sort of courtly, romantic way. And then he started to turn against her, and he would be really vile to her and humiliate her in front of other people. And she could never understand why. And her rationale was that when Maxwell belatedly discovered his Judaism, he blamed her for not being Jewish. Mm. I'm not so sure about it. I think that there was something about Maxwell's character that drove everyone away, including those who he ought to have felt closest to. And so Betty ends up, ostensibly she was this rather delicate looking woman, completely dwarfed by her increasingly enormous husband. But she was very, very tough herself.
When you look at them as a young couple, of course, he's quite dashing as a young man, at least on the pictures I've seen. They're also in the book. And so they're a good-looking couple. And of course, then over the years, he changes into this the way we see him today as a this big man, he's ballooned. They look like quite different early on. One thing I was thinking about with, and maybe it's a lot of people that they find themselves in his orbit, and I wonder with Betty, it seems like she's doing everything to try to get close to him. I mean, she's even later in her life, she starts to study his ancestors and his past. And what happened there?
And indeed, she actually became a very respected Holocaust
scholar.
I think that she valiantly kept the family together at a time when Maxwell himself was spending less and less time at home. I mean, he certainly had affairs. Mm. And, you know, did he simply fall out of love with her? He certainly did fall in love with his PA much later on, and that was one of the things that kind of tipped him over the edge, as it were. I think possibly he basically, there was something, some inner kind of core of Maxwell that he guarded very zealously and didn't want anyone to see, including himself. And I suspect he felt that Betty had seen into the heart of him. Oh. And he didn't like that, and he possibly resented it, and therefore kind of threw all those feelings back at her with a lot of kind of venom on top.
Because he also seems to keep his sort of children out of the limelight, in a sense. The relationship seems in many ways to be shrouded in secrecy. And of course, he had 9 children. And there's an explanation to that. At least you presented as that in the book. But also, he faced many calamities, notably the paralysis and death of his son Michael. So who was Maxwell the father?
Well, you know, that is a very, very good question, because when Michael, he spent 7 years in a coma in a hospital that was approximately a mile away from where the Maxwell's house was in Oxford. And in all that time, Betty was under the impression that Maxwell had never been to see Michael. But that turned out not to be the case. I talked to Maxwell's chauffeur, who said that quite often he would drive Maxwell down at night from his office in London, and they would go to the hospital, and Maxwell would sit by Michael's bed and talk to him and hope that he was, you know, his conversation would elicit some reaction, which it never did. So that begs the obvious question, why did Maxwell not tell his wife about it? And the only plausible explanation really is because he didn't want to show her how desperately hurt he was. He couldn't bear to admit to that degree of vulnerability.
I mean, Maxwell then later named his yacht, the Lady Ghislaine, after his youngest daughter, now, as you pointed out in the news. Was their relationship a special one? And how far do you think, you know, well, his behaviour shaped Ghislaine's life, and did he shape his daughter, you think, in any way?
Well, I think that Ghislaine, as I say, Ghislaine's birth and her early years were really overshadowed by this terrible dark cloud that had settled over the family as a result of Michael's accidents. So she was virtually ignored for quite a lot of it, so much so that actually aged kind of 4, she walks into her mother and stamps her foot and says, "Mummy, I exist." And having been an outsider...
Extraordinary thing for 4-year-old
to say. Yeah, no, exactly. And having been an outsider, she then actually becomes Maxwell's favourite child, so much so, of course, that he does name the yacht after her. But I'm very sceptical of drawing too convenient a line between Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, you know, yes, they, you know, what do they have in common? Well, plainly they were both very rich. But Maxwell was a completely different character to Epstein. You know, Epstein's a much more kind of shadowy figure. And also, you know, we don't know what happened. And, you know, Ghislaine hasn't yet come to trial, and it's entirely possible she might get off.
Yeah. So, but going back to Robert Maxwell, so tell us about his early ventures into politics. What were his motives, and why did he fail to get elected to the House of Commons at first?
Well, he decided that he wanted to become an MP. Actually, he pretty much decided he wanted to become Prime Minister before he became an MP, which was kind of fairly typical of Maxwell. And he did succeed in becoming a Labour MP. and always claimed that he was, socialist by conviction. Whether that's true or not is kind of open to debate. I think that in many respects, Maxwell was more of a natural conservative than he was a natural socialist. Mm. But he kind of sniffed out that the British establishment were never going to allow him in. So he felt that the Labour Party was a much better bet. He became MP for Buckingham. He was a conscientious, good Labour MP. But he infuriated his fellow Labour MPs and the then Prime Minister, Harold Wilson. They couldn't stop him giving speeches in the House of Commons. And Labour MPs would kind of tug on his jacket in this kind of frantic bid to get him to sit down, but to no avail. And in fact, the only position of responsibility he ever got in Westminster was being put in charge of the House of Commons Catering Committee, which was running at a terrible loss. And actually, Maxwell did succeed in transforming its fortunes.
And also got a bit of, at least it sounds like it, got a bit of that extraordinary wine cellar.
That's never been into. I mean, basically, Maxwell balanced the books of the House of Commons Catering Committee, in part by selling off a large slice of the wine cellar, which was reputed to be the best wine cellar in Europe. And he wouldn't reveal the identity of the person he'd sold it to. And after a bit, everyone forgot about it. But certainly in years to come, no one who went to dinner at Headington Hill Hall, his house, failed to come away without noticing that the wines had been quite outstandingly good.
No, and it's also, I must say that story in itself, it tells you a lot about the ingenuity and also in a good way how he can handle sort of the establishment. His responses to people criticizing for what he's done with the catering service are quite funny, and it's something to read in the book. But it's a great story. It tells you a lot about his character. Tell us a bit about the relationship between Maxwell and Rupert Murdoch. Famous Australian media tycoon and owner of the Times, the News of the World, and many other papers. What drove Maxwell to compete with Murdoch so fervently, you think?
Well, they'd started off potentially as business partners, because in 1963, Maxwell was in Australia and he met Murdoch. And they agreed to go into a business selling encyclopedias in Australia and Southeast Asia. Now, actually, Murdoch, when I went to see him, said he was completely spellbound, or certainly fairly spellbound, by Maxwell, and was very keen on this idea and agreed to stump up $1 million to become Maxwell's partner. But before the contract could be signed, and Murdoch happened to have lunch with a friend of his who was a publisher, and he was explaining about this great deal he'd got with this extraordinary man, Maxwell. And the friend of his started laughing, and Murdoch said, "Well, what are you laughing at?" And the friend said, no, don't touch that. Because it turned out the encyclopedias were in fact bankrupt stock, which had been offloaded onto Maxwell for nothing. And Maxwell was trying to get Murdoch to pay us $1 million for them. So Murdoch, who found the whole thing quite funny, vowed never to have anything to do with Maxwell in future. But in fact, their fates were kind of entwined for the next pushing 30 years. And every time Maxwell tried to buy a newspaper, Murdoch would kind of, as it seemingly kind of snatch it from under his nose. And it drove Maxwell nuts, really. I mean, as far as Murdoch was concerned, Maxwell, he regarded Maxwell really as this kind of braggart and someone he didn't take particularly seriously. But as far as Maxwell was concerned, Murdoch really kind of became his nemesis. And indeed, it's actually in seeking to go toe-to-toe with Murdoch that Maxwell really set in train the chain of events that would lead to the disintegration of his business empire, his own physical and mental disintegration, and ultimately his death.
Mm. But if you take that first meeting they have, and as you say, Murdoch found him fascinating and taken by him, and that tells you a bit about, I mean, he comes across from time to time as a confidence man in the original sense. Just that he seems to have this ability to win people over in first meeting. And at sometimes also later on, I wonder if this is true. I want to hear your thoughts on this. That when he gets a bad reputation, it seems like in your interviews that very often people are almost surprised that when they met him, he actually came across as quite nice or at least not horrible. And he could sort of use that kind of low expectations to make people feel special.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. He was certainly capable of being very charming. He was highly intelligent. I mean, you know, when he was working, when he was publishing scientific journals in the 50s, I mean, the scientists absolutely revered him. Now, of course, in part, that was because he was giving them a platform to, you know, disseminate their research and so on. But they also liked and respected him because he could talk to them on their terms. And yes, he was certainly capable of browbeating people into submission. But he was also capable of charming them into submission as well. I mean, I think he possibly could argue that submission tended to be the goal in both cases. but again, you know, it's one of those fundamental contradictions at the heart of Maxwell.
Yeah. Among what you call his vast lake of insecurities, was Maximus' belief that he was sort of permanently an outsider to the British establishment, and despite changing his name, his accent, and his religion, you know. And in many ways, then, the story of Robert Maxwell is also a story about disruptors, I suppose, and how they get their way in the world of conformity. Would you agree on that?
Yes. Yeah, I would. I would. I mean, you know, to me, there was something. I mean, yeah, there's a lot about Maxwell that isn't admirable, but I found there's something both admirable and engaging about the way that he kind of stuck two fingers up to traditional notions of British politesse. And also that he'd kind of, you know, lived life completely on his own terms, which few of us can say that we managed to do. But nonetheless, you know, behind that kind of bombastic manner was somebody who quite possibly never entirely knew who they really were. And, you know, when he takes over the Mirror in 1984, he really becomes this figure of fun because he just puts pictures of himself all over the paper. And, you know, why did he do that? And, yeah, the short answer, I suppose, is because, you know, he was an egomaniac. You also feel that he somehow needed some sort of public validation to prove that he was who he appeared to be.
Yeah, and there's also tragedy in that because, I mean, obviously he's like a shapeshifter. And this made him an excellent networker. And, you know, he had his all his connection with the British royal family and in politics and business and media. But then he has these extravagant parties at Headington Hill Hall. And what struck me when I read the book is actually not what I found almost appalling was not the parties he threw or you know the way he portrayed himself. It's actually what people said about him when they left, you know. So they go to these. So you have all these people go to these fantastic parties, and then they criticize his furniture and his art, and call him a vulgar man.
Yeah, exactly. So there was a lot of, you know, tremendous hypocrisy there, and they loved, you know, and there was a whole kind of almost industry of people who were, you know, violently sucking up to Maxwell on the one hand and, you know, sniggering behind their hands on the other, a lot of whom were in the city and, you know, hurled money at him when it suited them and then turned around and said what a dreadful man he was. So, you know, he suffered from terrible humbug in that respect.
By 1991... Maxwell now owned the New York Daily News, the Daily Mirror, and the Daily Express in the UK, and also Macmillan Publishing, and countless other titles. So how did Maxwell's orbital influence shape the future of the media in the 1990s, do you think?
Well, I think you have to... I think there's a very interesting thing that happens with, with the recent past, as I think Alan Bennett said, is the most boring period of all. But then you go back a bit further and you kind of tilt over a point where it becomes history. And then potentially it does become interesting, particularly if there's a big contrast between the way we lived then and the way we live now. Mm-hmm. In the case of Very English Scandal, the big difference, of course, was attitudes towards homosexuality. Mm. With Maxwell, it's really the way in which power works. And that has changed out of all recognition. I mean, in the 1980s, when Maxwell buys the Mirror, he and Rupert Murdoch are the two biggest power brokers in British political life. Murdoch has the Sun, and the Conservative Party know that in order to stay in power or be re-elected, they have to have the support of the Sun. And the same is true with the Labour Party and the Mirror. So these two men wielded enormous power and influence. Mm. Murdoch very much had his own political agenda. Maxwell, less so. He kind of, in many respects, just liked power for the sake of power. Mm. But he still made life extremely difficult for Neil Kinnock, the then Labour leader. But yes, they were enormously powerful. And, and power now, of course, there are very rich people who are tremendously powerful, but that tends to be more in the shadows, with people not banging a political agenda or even having that much of a public profile.
Mm. Reading the book, I had his thought that he was more comfortable with a battle where not everything was going his way. And then suddenly, during the final years, to begin with, it sort of seems, I mean, he has this vast empire, but it's also then when he becomes increasingly frenetic and paranoid. So what happens there, you think?
I think that, in purely economic terms, Maxwell in 1988 bought the American publishers Macmillan for an insane amount of money. $1 billion more than the company's own directors thought it was worth. And he did that principally because he wanted to go toe-to-toe with Rupert Murdoch in the States. Mm. But then there's a recession, interest rates soar, and from that moment on, the cracks are starting to widen, and it's only really going to end one way. But then you've also got Maxwell's own kind of personal disintegration. Mm. And, you have a sense that he's frantic. I mean, this is my speculation, and I don't know, but I had this constant sense of Maxwell frantically grasping for this kind of elusive thing that was going to bring him a measure of contentment and satisfaction. And of course, he never got it. And, he did get huge amounts of money, but that ultimately I don't think meant very much. And, he was lonely, looking for love, and a tremendously sad figure, actually, and a tragic figure. And as I said before, at the end of his life, he's really backed himself into this terrible corner. And he sits up in his apartment in Maxwell House and he gorges himself on Chinese takeaways and watches old Clint Eastwood movies. It's a really poignant story.
And also, of course, then, only months after arriving in New York to purchase the Daily News, Maxwell died while on his yacht. So, and there's still, I suppose, speculation on what actually happened. So can you sort of give us a few theories of, was it suicide? I mean, speculation even about murder. What do you think?
Well, Maxwell, the beginning of November 1991, set off, went and flew out and joined the Lady Ghislaine. He'd never been on board the yacht by himself before. There'd always been a kind of retinue of other guests. The staff were there, of course, but other than that, Maxwell was alone. So that was unusual. And they cruised rather aimlessly around the Canary Islands for a bit. And then you know, in the early hours of November the 5th, 1991, Maxwell disappears overboard. And later that day, he's due to fly back to London, where he's going to be facing the equivalent of three firing squads, as it were, because he knows that the fraud squad are after him, the banks are after him, and the Mirror pensioners are after him. So, you know, was he bumped off? Certainly, there's a whole queue of people who have been, willing to bump him off. But there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that he was bumped off. So was it suicide? Was it an accident? If it was an accident, it was an astonishingly fortuitous one, given that he knew the game was up. And I think he would have found the humiliation of that very hard to bear. But we can't say for sure that he committed suicide. And my own suspicion is that possibly the line between suicide and accident is rather less clear-cut than we tend to assume. So my guess is that the answer lies somewhere along that line.
Yeah. And how did the Maxwell Empire come apart after his death? And how was his fraud revealed?
Well, this is the extraordinary thing, where Maxwell dies, all these world leaders, practically all world leaders queue up to pay incredibly extravagant tributes to him. And he's buried, he's given the equivalent of a state funeral in Israel, buried in the Mount of Olives. And it's only 3-4 weeks later that it's revealed that there's this vast hole in the Mirror pension funds. And it becomes clear that Maxwell has looted the funds to try and keep his empire afloat. They have the extraordinary sight of half of the same people who'd been queuing up to pay tribute to him now saying what a dreadful person he was, and they'd always had their suspicions about him and so on and so forth. there's a tremendous amount of humbug.
I wonder, are there any lessons to be learned from the rise and fall of Robert Maxwell?
Well, it's a terrible tale of hubris. And it has something of a Shakespearean tragedy about it. It felt when I was writing it, I quite often feel it was like the Great Gatsby and Citizen Kane rolled into one. It's a sort of terrible lesson in be careful what you wish for. Maxwell had succeeded in getting so many of the things in life that we all tend to assume would make us happy if ever we got them. And they didn't. And instead, they really, you could argue, brought him nothing but pain and anguish, certainly towards the end.
John Preston, thank you very much.
Thank you.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.